off abruptly, jaw clamped. "No," he said again, very definitely. His hand slid down to take hold of mine, and with the other he reached down to pick up the photographs. He laid them on his knee, looking at them with head bent, so I couldn't see his face.
"Brianna," he said softly. "You say it wrong, Sassenach. Her name is Brianna."
He said it with an odd Highland lilt, so that the first syllable was accented, the second barely pronounced. "Brianna." "Brianna," I said, amused. He nodded, eyes still fixed on the pictures.
"Brianna," he said. "It's a beautiful name."
"Glad you like it," I said. He glanced up then and met my eyes with a smile hidden in the corner of his long mouth.
"Tell me about her."
One forefinger traced the pudgy features of the baby in the snowsuit.
"What was she like as a wee lassie? What did she first say when she learned to speak?"
His hand drew me closer, and I nestled close to him. He was big and solid and smelled of clean linen and ink, with a warm male scent that was as exciting to me as it was familiar. "Dog," I said. "That was her first word. The second one was no."
The smile widened across his face. "Aye, they all learn that one fast. She'll like dogs then."
He fanned the pictures out like cards, searching out the one with Smokey.
"That's a lovely dog with her there. What sort is that?"
"A Newfoundland." I bent forward to thumb through the pictures. "There's another one here with a puppy a friend of mine gave her." The dim grey daylight had begun to fade, and the rain had been pattering on the roof for some time, before our talk was interrupted by a fierce subterranean growl emanating from below the lace-trimmed bodice of my Jessica Gutenberg. It had been a long time since the peanut butter sandwich.
"Hungry, Sassenach?" Jamie asked.
"Rather unnecessarily, I thought." "Well, yes, now that you mention it. Do you still keep food in the top drawer?" When we were first married, I had developed the habit of keeping small bits of food on hand to supply his constant appetite, and the top drawer of any chest of drawers where we lived generally provided a selection of rolls, small cakes, or bits of cheese. He laughed and stretched.
"Aye, I do. There's no so much there just now, though, but a couple of stale bannocks. Better I take you down to the tavern and..."
The look of happiness engendered by perusing the photographs of Brianna faded to be replaced by a look of alarm. He glanced quickly at the window, where a soft purplish colour was beginning to replace the pale grey, and the look of alarm deepened.
"The tavern! Christ, I've forgotten Mr. Willoughby!"
He was on his feet and groping in the chest for fresh stockings before I could say anything. Coming out with the stockings in one hand and two bannocks in the other, he tossed the latter into my lap and sat down on the stool, hastily yanking on the former.
"Who's Mr. Willoughby?"
I bit into a bannock, scattering crumbs.
"Damn," he said,
more to himself than me.
I said I'd come for him at noon, but it went out of my head entirely. It must be 4 o'clock by now.
"It is. I heard the clock strike a little while ago."
"Damn,"
he repeated. Thrusting his feet into a pair of pewter-buckled shoes, he rose, snatched his coat from the peg, and then paused at the door.
"You'll come wi' me?" he asked anxiously.
I licked my fingers and rose, pulling my cloak around me. "Wild horses couldn't stop me," I assured him. Chapter 25. House of Joy. "Who is Mr. Willoughby?" I inquired, as we paused under the arch of Carfax Close to peer out at the cobbled street.
"He's an associate of mine,"
Jamie replied, with a wary glance at me.
"Best put up your hood. It's pouring."
It was, in fact, raining quite hard. Sheets of water fell from the arch overhead and gurgled down the gutters, cleansing the streets of sewage and rubbish. I took a deep breath of the damp, clean air, feeling exhilarated by the wildness of the evening and the closeness of Jamie, tall and powerful by my side. I had found him. I had found him, and whatever unknowns life now held, they didn't seem to matter. I felt reckless and indestructible. I took his hand and squeezed it. He looked down and smiled at me, squeezing back. Where are we going?
To the world's end.
The roar of the water made conversation difficult. Without further speech, Jamie took me by the elbow to help me across the cobbles, and we plunged down the steep incline of the Royal Mile. Luckily, the tavern called the World's End was no more than 100 yards away. Hard as the rain was, the shoulders of my cloak were scarcely more than dampened when we ducked beneath the lintel and into the narrow entry hall. The main room was crowded, warm and smoky, a snug refuge from the storm outside. There were a few women seated on the benches that ran along the walls, but most of the patrons were men. Here and there was a man in the well-kept dress of a merchant, but most men with homes to go to were in them at this hour. The tavern hosted a mix of soldiers, wharf rats, labourers and apprentices, with here and there the odd drunkard for variety. Heads looked up at our appearance, and there were shouts of greeting and a general shuffling and pushing to make room at one of the long tables. Clearly, Jamie was well known in the World's End. A few curious glances came my way, but no one said anything. I kept my cloak pulled close around me and followed Jamie through the crush of the tavern.
"Nay, mistress, we'll no be staying," he said to the young barmaid, who bustled forward with an eager smile. "I've only come for himself."
The girl rolled her eyes. "Oh, aye, and no before time either. Mither's put him down the stair."
"I am late," Jamie said apologetically. "I had business that kept me."
The girl looked curiously at me, but then shrugged and dimpled at Jamie. "Oh, it's no trouble, sir. Harry took him down a stoup of brandy, and we've heard little more of him since."
"Brandy, eh?"
Jamie sounded resigned.
"Still awake, is he?"
He reached into the pocket of his coat and brought out a small leather pouch, from which he extracted several coins, which he dropped into the girl's outstretched hand. "I expect so," she said cheerfully, pocketing the money. "I heard him singing a while since. Thank you, sir." With a nod, Jamie ducked under the lintel at the back of the room, motioning me to follow. A tiny, barrel-ceilinged kitchen lay behind the main taproom, with a huge kettle of what looked like oyster stew simmering in the hearth. It smelled delicious, and I could feel my mouth starting to water at the rich aroma. I hoped we could do our business with Mr. Willoughby over supper. A fat woman in a grimy bodice and skirt knelt by the hearth, stuffing billets of wood into the fire. She glanced up at Jamie and nodded, but made no move to get up. He lifted a hand in response and headed for a small wooden door in the corner. He lifted the bolt and swung the door open to reveal a dark stairway leading down, apparently, into the bowels of the earth. A light flickered somewhere far below, as though elves were mining diamonds beneath the tavern. Jamie's shoulders filled the narrow stairwell, obstructing my view of whatever lay below us. When he stepped out into the open space below, I could see heavy oak rafters and a row of huge casks standing on a long plank set on hurdles against the stone wall. Only a single torch burned at the foot of the stair. The cellar was shadowy, and its cave-like depths seemed quite deserted. I listened, but didn't hear anything but the muffled racket of the tavern upstairs. Certainly no singing. "Are you sure he's down here?" I bent to peer beneath the row of casks, wondering whether perhaps the bibulous Mr. Willoughby had been overcome with an excess of brandy and sought some secluded spot to sleep it off.
"Oh, aye." Jamie sounded grim but resigned. "The wee bugger's hiding, I expect. He knows I dinna like it when he drinks in public houses."
I raised an eyebrow at this, but he merely strode into the shadows, muttering under his breath. The cellar stretched some way, and I could hear him shuffling cautiously in the dark long after I lost sight of him. Left in the circle of torchlight near the stairs, I looked around with interest. Beside the row of casks, there were a number of wooden crates stacked near the centre of the room, against an odd little chunk of wall that stood by itself, rising some 5 feet out of the cellar floor, running back into the darkness. I had heard of this feature of the tavern when we had stayed in Edinburgh 20 years before with His Highness Prince Charles, but what with one thing and another, I had never actually seen it before. It was the remnant of a wall constructed by the city fathers of Edinburgh, following the disastrous Battle of Flodden Field in 1513. Concluding, with some justice, that no good was likely to come of association with the English to the south, they had built a wall defining both the city limits and the limit of the civilized world of Scotland. Hence, the world's end. And the name had stuck through several versions of the tavern that had eventually been built upon the remnants of the old Scots' wishful thinking.
Damned little bugger!
Jamie emerged from the shadows, a cobweb stuck in his hair and a frown on his face.
He must be back of the wall.
Turning, he put his hands to his mouth and shouted something. It sounded like incomprehensible gibberish, not even like Gaelic. I dug a finger dubiously into one ear, wondering whether the trip through the stones had deranged my hearing. A sudden movement caught the corner of my eye, causing me to look up, just in time to see a ball of brilliant blue fly off the top of the ancient wall and smack Jamie squarely between the shoulder blades. He hit the cellar floor with a frightful thump, and I dashed toward his fallen body. Jamie! Are you all right? The prone figure made a number of coarse remarks in Gaelic and sat up slowly, rubbing his forehead, which had struck the stone floor a glancing blow. The blue ball, meanwhile, had resolved itself into the figure of a very small Chinese who was giggling in unhinged delight, sallow round face shining with glee and brandy. Mr. Willoughby, I presume, I said to this apparition, keeping a wary eye out for further tricks. He appeared to recognise his name, for he grinned and nodded madly at me, his eyes creased to gleaming slits. He pointed to himself, said something in Chinese, and then sprang into the air and executed several backflips in rapid succession, bobbing up on his feet in beaming triumph at the end.
Bloody flea!
Jamie got up, wiping the skinned palms of his hands gingerly on his coat. With a quick snatch, he caught hold of the Chinaman's collar and jerked him off his feet.
"Come on,"
he said, parking the little man on the stairway and prodding him firmly in the back.
"We need to be going, and quick now."
In response, the little blue-clad figure promptly sagged into limpness, looking like a bag of laundry resting on the step.
"He's all right when he's sober," Jamie explained apologetically to me as he hoisted the Chinese over one shoulder. "But he really shouldn't have drink brandy. He's a terrible sort."
"So I see. Where on earth did you get him?" Fascinated, I followed Jamie up the stairs, watching Mr. Willoughby's pigtail swing back and forth like a metronome across the felted grey wool of Jamie's cloak.
"On the docks."
But before he could explain further, the door above opened, and we were back in the tavern's kitchen. The stout proprietor saw us emerge and came toward us, her fat cheeks puffed with disapproval.
"Now, Mr. Malcolm," she began, frowning, "you ken very weel as you're welcome here, and you'll ken as weel that I'm no a fussy woman, such not being a convenient attitude when maintaining a public house. But I've tell you before, yon wee yellow manny is no..."
"Aye, you've mentioned it, Mrs. Patterson,"
Jamie interrupted. He dug in his pocket and came up with a coin, which he handed to the stout publican with a bow.
"And your forbearance is much appreciated. It will not happen again, I hope," he added under his breath.
He placed his hat on his head, bowed again to Mrs. Patterson, and ducked under the low lintel into the main tavern. Our re-entry caused another stir, but a negative one this time. People fell silent or muttered half-heard curses under their breath. I gathered that Mr. Willoughby was perhaps not this local's most popular patron. Jamie edged his way through the crowd, which gave reluctantly. I followed as best as I could, trying not to meet anyone's eyes and trying not to breathe. unused as I was to the unhygienic miasma of the 18th century, the stench of so many unwashed bodies in a small space was nearly overwhelming. Near the door, though, we met trouble in the person of a buxom young woman whose dress was a notch above the sober drab of the landlady and her daughter. Her neckline was a notch lower, and I hadn't much trouble in guessing her principal occupation. Absorbed in flirtatious conversation with a couple of apprentice lads when we emerged from the kitchen, she looked up as we passed and sprang to her feet with a piercing scream, knocking over a cup of ale in the process. "It's him!" she screeched, pointing a wavering finger at Jamie. "The foul fiend!" Her eyes seemed to have trouble focusing. I gathered that the spilled ale wasn't her first of the evening, early as it was. Her companion stared at Jamie with interest, the more so when the young lady advanced, stabbing her finger in the air like one leading a chorus. "Him, the wee balty I tell ye of, him that did the disgusting thing to me?" I joined the rest of the crowd in looking at Jamie with interest, but quickly realised, as did they, that the young woman wasn't talking to him, but rather to his burden. "Ye neffit curd!" she yelled, addressing her remarks to the seat of Mr. Willoughby's blue silk trousers. "Hiddypike! Slug!" This spectacle of maidenly distress was rousing her companions. One, a tall, burly lad, stood up, fists clenched, and leaned on the table, eyes gleaming with ale and aggro.
"Sam, I shall I nivel him for ye, Maggie?"
"Dinna try, laddie," Jamie advised him shortly, shifting his burden for better balance.
"Drink your drink, and we'll be gone."
"Oh, aye, and you're the little kid's pimp master, are ye?"
The lad sneered unbecomingly, his flushed face turning in my direction.
"At least your other whore's no yellow. Let's see a look at her."
He flung out a paw and grabbed the edge of my cloak, revealing the low bodice of the Jessica Gutenberg.
"Looks pink enough to me," said his friend with obvious approval. "Is she like it all over?"
Before I could move, he snatched at the bodice, catching the edge of the lace. Not designed for the rigours of 18th century life, the flimsy fabric ripped halfway down the side, exposing quite a lot of pink.
"Leave off your horsin',"
Jamie swung about, eyes blazing, free fist doubled in threat.
"Who you miscalling, you scray skanket scoot?"
The first youth, unable to get out from behind the table, leapt on top of it and launched himself at Jamie, who neatly sidestepped the lad, allowing him to crash face first into the wall. Jamie took one giant step toward the table, brought his fist down hard on the top of the other apprentice's head, making the lad's jaw go slack, then grabbed me by the hand and dragged me out the door.
"Come on," he said, grunting as he shifted the Chinaman's slippery form for a better grip. "They'll be after us any moment."
They were. I could hear the shouting as the more boisterous elements poured out of the tavern into the street behind us. Jamie took the first opening off the Royal Mile into a narrow, dark wind, and we splashed through mud and unidentifiable slops, ducked through an archway and down another twisting alleyway that seemed to lead through the bowels of Edinburgh. Dark walls flashed past and splintered wooden doors, and then we were round a corner in a small courtyard where we paused for breath.
"What on earth did he do?" I gasped. I couldn't imagine what the little Chinese could have done to a strapping young wench like the recent Maggie. From all appearances, she could have squashed him like a fly.
"Well, it's the feet, you kin,"
Jamie explained, with a glance of resigned irritation at Mr. Willoughby.
"Feet?"
I glanced involuntarily at the tiny Chinese man's feet, neat miniatures shod in felt-soled black satin.
"Not his," Jamie said, catching my glance. "The women's."
"What women?" I asked.
"Well, so far it's only been whores," he said, glancing through the archway in search of pursuit. "But you cannot tell what he may try."
"No judgment," he explained briefly. "He's a heathen."
"I see,"
I said, though so far I didn't.
"What?"
There they are!
A shout at the far end of the alley interrupted my question.
Damn! I thought they'd give it up. Come on, this way.
We were off once more, down an alley, back onto the Royal Mile, a few steps down the hill, and back into a close. I could hear shouts and cries behind us on the main street, but Jamie grasped my arm and jerked me after him through an open doorway into a yard full of casks, bundles and crates. He looked frantically about, then heaved Mr. Willoughby's limp body into a large barrel filled with rubbish. Pausing only long enough to drop a piece of canvas on the Chinese's head for concealment, he dragged me behind a wagon loaded with crates and pulled me down beside him. I was gasping from the unaccustomed exertion, and my heart was racing from the adrenaline of fear. Jamie's face was flushed with cold and exercise, and his hair was sticking up in several directions, but he was scarcely breathing hard.
"Do you do this sort of thing all the time?" I asked,
pressing a hand to my bosom in a vain effort to make my heart slow down.
"Not exactly," he said,
peering warily over the top of the wagon in search of pursuit. The echo of pounding feet came faintly, then disappeared, and everything was quiet save for the patter of rain on the boxes above us.
"They've gone past. We'd best stay here a bit to make sure, though."
He lifted down a crate for me to sit on, procured another for himself, and sat down, sighing, pushing the loose hair out of his face with one hand. He gave me a lopsided smile.
"I'm sorry, Sassenach. I didn't think it would be quite so...
eventful," I finished for him. I smiled back and pulled out a handkerchief to wipe a drop of moisture from the end of my nose. "It's all right." I glanced at the large barrel where stirrings and rustlings indicated that Mr. Willoughby was returning to a more or less conscious state.
How do you know about the feet?"
"He told me. He's a taste for the drink, you ken," he explained, with a glance at the barrel where his colleague lay concealed. "And when he's taken a drop too much, he starts talking about women's feet and all the horrible things he wants to do with them."
"What sort of horrible things can you do with a foot?"
I was fascinated. "Surely the possibilities are limited."
"No, they aren't," Jamie said grimly. "But it isn't a something I want to be talking about in the public street."
This ends Disc 11. Voyager, Disc 12.
A faint sing-song came from the depths of the barrel behind us. It was hard to tell, amid the natural inflections of the language, but I thought Mr. Willoughby was asking a question of some sort.
"Shut up, you wee poutworm," Jamie said rudely. "Another word and I'll walk on your damn face myself. See how you like that."
There was a high-pitched giggle, and the barrel fell silent.
"He wants someone to walk on his face?" I asked.
"Aye, you,"
Jamie said briefly. He shrugged apologetically, and his cheeks flushed a deeper red.
"I hadn't time to tell him who you were."
"Does he speak English?"
"Oh, aye, in a way. But not many people understand him when he does. I mostly talk to him in Chinese."
I stared at him.
"You speak Chinese?"
He shrugged, tilting his head with a faint smile.
"Well, I speak Chinese about as well as Mr. Willoughby speaks English. But then, he hasn't got all that much choice in who he talks to, so he puts up with me."
My heart showed signs of returning to normal, and I leaned back against the wagon bed, my hood farther forward against the drizzle.
"Where on earth did he get a name like Willoughby?" I asked.
While I was curious about the Chinese, I was even more curious about what a respectable Edinburgh printer was doing with one. But I felt a certain hesitance in prying into Jamie's life. Freshly returned from the supposed dead, or its equivalent, I could hardly demand to know all the details of his life on the spot. Jamie rubbed a hand across his nose.
"Aye, well, it's only that his real name is Yi Tiang Cho. He says it means leans against heaven."
Too hard for the local Scots to pronounce? Knowing the insular nature of most Scots, I wasn't surprised that they were disinclined to venture into strange linguistic waters. Jamie, with his gift for tongues, was a genetic anomaly. He smiled, teeth a white gleam in the gathering darkness.
Well, it's no that so much. It's only, if you see his name just a wee bit off, it sounds very much like a coarse word in Gaelic. I thought Willoughby would maybe do better.
I see. I thought perhaps under the circumstances I shouldn't ask just what the indelicate Gaelic word was. I glanced over my shoulder, but the coast seemed clear. Jamie caught the gesture and rose, nodding.
Aye, we can go now. The lads will have gone back to the tavern by now.
Won't we have to pass the World's End on the way back to the print shop? I asked dubiously. Or is there a back way? It was full dark by now, and the thought of stumbling through the middens and muddy back passages of Edinburgh was unappealing.
No. We will not be going to the print shop.
I couldn't see his face, but there seemed a certain reserve in his manner. Perhaps he had a residence somewhere else in the city. I felt a certain hollowness at the prospect. The room above the print shop was very clearly a monk's cell, but perhaps he had an entire house somewhere else, with a family in it. There had been no time for any but the most essential exchange of information at the print shop. I had no way of knowing what he had done over the last 20 years, or what he might be doing now. Still, he had plainly been glad, to say the least, to see me, and the air of frowning consideration he now bore might well have to do with his inebriated associate, rather than with me. He bent over the barrel, saying something in Scots-accented Chinese. This was one of the odder sounds I had ever heard, rather like the squeaks of a bagpipe tuning up, I thought, vastly entertained by the performance. Whatever he'd said, Mr. Willoughby replied to it volubly, interrupting himself with giggles and snorts. At last, the little Chinese climbed out of the barrel, his diminutive figure silhouetted by the light of a distant lantern in the alleyway. He sprang down with fair agility and promptly prostrated himself on the ground before me. Bearing in mind what Jamie had told me about the feet, I took a quick step back, but Jamie laid a reassuring hand on my arm.
"Nay, that's all right, Sassenach," he said. "He's only making amends for his disrespect to you earlier."
"Oh, well." I looked dubiously at Mr. Willoughby, who was gabbling something to the ground under his face. At a loss for the proper etiquette, I stooped down and patted him on the head. Evidently that was all right, for he leapt to his feet and bowed to me several times, until Jamie told him impatiently to stop, and we made our way back to the Royal Mile. The building Jamie led us to was discreetly hidden down a small close just above the Kirk of the Canongate, perhaps a quarter mile above Holyrood Palace. I saw the lanterns mounted by the gates of the palace below, and shivered slightly at the sight. We had lived with Charles Stuart in the palace for nearly 5 weeks in the early victorious phase of his short career. Jamie's uncle, Colum Mackenzie, had died there. The door opened to Jamie's knock, and all thoughts of the past vanished. The woman who stood peering out at us, candle in hand, was petite, dark-haired, and elegant. Seeing Jamie, she drew him in with a glad cry and kissed his cheek in greeting. My insides squeezed tight as a fist, but then relaxed again as I heard him greet her as Madame Jeanne. Not what one would call a wife, nor yet, I hoped, a mistress. Still, there was something about the woman that made me uneasy. She was clearly French, though she spoke English well. Not so odd. Edinburgh was a seaport and a fairly cosmopolitan city. She was dressed soberly but richly in heavy silk cut with a flare,
but she wore a good deal more rouge and powder than the average Scotswoman. What disturbed me was the way she was looking at me, frowning with a palpable air of distaste.
"Monsieur Fraser," she said, touching Jamie on the shoulder with a possessive air that I didn't like at all, "if I might have a word in private with you."
Jamie, handing his cloak to the maid who came to fetch it, took a quick look at me and read the situation at once.
"Of course, Madame Jeanne," he said courteously, reaching out a hand to draw me forward. "But first, allow me to introduce my wife, Madame Fraser."
My heart stopped beating for a moment, then resumed with a force that I was sure was audible to everyone in the small entry hall. Jamie's eyes met mine, and he smiled, the grip of his fingers tightening on my arm.
"Your wife?"
I couldn't tell whether astonishment or horror was more pronounced on Madame Jeanne's face.
"But, Monsieur Fraser, you bring her here? I thought a woman well enough, but to insult our own jeune fille is not good. But then a wife?"
Her mouth hung open, unbecomingly, displaying several decayed molars. Then she shook herself suddenly back into an attitude of flustered poise and inclined her head to me with an attempt at graciousness.
"Bonsoir, madame."
"Likewise, I'm sure," I said politely.
"Is my room ready, madame?" Jamie said.
Without waiting for an answer, he turned toward the stair, taking me with him.
"We shall be spending the night."
He glanced back at Mr. Willoughby, who had come in with us. He had sat down at once on the floor, where he sat dripping rain, a dreamy expression on his small, flat face. Jamie made a small questioning motion toward Mr. Willoughby, his eyebrows raised at Madame Jeanne. She stared at the little Chinese for a moment, as though wondering where he had come from, then returned to herself, clapped her hands briskly for the maid.
"See if Mademoiselle Josie is at liberty, if you please, Pauline," she said, "and then fetch up hot water and fresh towels for Monsieur Fraser and his wife."
She spoke the word with a sort of stunned amazement, as though she still didn't quite believe it.
"Oh, and one thing more, if you would be so kind, madame."
Jamie leaned over the banister, smiling down at her.
"My wife will require a fresh gown. She has had an unfortunate accident to her wardrobe. If you could provide something suitable by morning." "Thank you, Madame Jeanne. Bonsoir."
I didn't speak as I followed him up four flights of winding stairs to the top of the house. I was much too busy thinking, my mind in a whirl. Pimp master, the lad in the pub had called him. But surely that was only an epithet. Such a thing was absolutely impossible. For the Jamie Fraser I had known it was impossible, I corrected myself, looking up at the broad shoulders under the dark grey serge coat. But for this man? I didn't know quite what I had been expecting. But the room was quite ordinary, small and clean. Though that was extraordinary, come to think of it. Furnished with a stool, a simple bed, and chest of drawers, upon which stood a basin and ewer, and a clay candlestick with a beeswax candle, which Jamie lighted from the taper he had carried up. He shucked off his wet coat and draped it carelessly on the stool, then sat down on the bed to remove his wet shoes.
"God," he said, "I'm starving. I hope the cook's not gone to bed yet."
"Jamie," I said.
"Take off your cloak, Sassenach," he said,
noticing me still standing against the door.
"You're soaked."
"Yes. Well, yes," I swallowed, and then went on. "There's just, Jamie, why have you got a regular room in a brothel?" I burst out. He rubbed his chin, looking mildly embarrassed.
"I'm sorry, Sassenach," he said. "I know it wasn't right to bring you here, but it was the only place I could think of where we might get your dress mended at short notice, besides finding a hot supper. And then I had to put Mr. Willoughby where he wouldn't get in more trouble. And as we had to come here anyway..." "Well?"
He glanced at the bed, It's a good deal more comfortable than my cot at the print shop. But perhaps it was a poor idea. We can leave if you feel it's not.
I don't mind about that, I interrupted. The question is, why have you got a room in a brothel? Are you such a good customer that... A customer?
He stared up at me, eyebrows raised.
Here? Good, Sassenach, what do you think I am?
Damned if I know, I said. That's why I'm asking.
Are you going to answer my question?
He stared at his stockinged feet for a moment, wiggling his toes on the floorboard. At last, he looked up at me and answered calmly,
I suppose so. I'm not a customer of Jeanne's, but she's a customer of mine, and a good one. She keeps a room for me because I'm often abroad late on business, and I'd as soon have a place I can come to where I can have food and a bed at any hour, and privacy. The room is part of my arrangement with her.
I had been holding my breath. Now I let out about half of it.
All right, I said. Then I suppose the next question is, what business has the owner of a brothel got with a printer?
The absurd thought that perhaps he printed advertising circulars for Madame Jeanne flitted through my brain to be instantly dismissed.
Well, he said slowly,
no. I dinna think that's the question. It's not.
No.
With one fluid move, he was off the bed and standing in front of me, close enough for me to have to look up into his face. I had a sudden urge to take a step backward, but didn't, largely because there wasn't room.
The question is, Sassenach, why have you come back?
He said softly.
That's a hell of a question to ask me.
My palms pressed flat against the rough wood of the door.
Why do you think I came back, damn you?
I dinna ken.
The soft Scottish voice was cool, but even in the dim light I could see the pulse throbbing in the open throat of his shirt.
Did you come to be my wife again? Or only to bring me word of my daughter?
As though he sensed that his nearness unnerved me, he turned away suddenly, moving toward the window, where the shutters creaked in the wind.
You are the mother of my child. For that alone I owe you my soul. For the knowledge that my life hasna been in vain, that my child is safe.
He turned again to face me, blue eyes intent.
But it has been a time, Sassenach, since you and I were one. You'll have had your life then. And I have had mine here. You'll know nothing of what I've done or been. Did you come now because you wanted to? Or because you felt you must?
My throat felt tight, but I met his eyes. I came now because before, I thought you were dead. I thought you'd died at Culloden. His eyes dropped to the windowsill, where he picked at a splinter.
Aye, I see,
he said softly.
Well, I meant to be dead.
He smiled without humour, eyes intent on the splinter.
I tried hard enough.
He looked up at me again.
How did you find out I hadna died? Or where I was come to that?
I had help. A young historian named Roger Wakefield found the records. He tracked you to Edinburgh. And when I saw A. Malcolm, I knew, I thought, it might be you, I ended lamely. Time enough for the details later.
Aye, I see. And then you came. But still, why?
I stared at him without speaking for a moment. As though he felt the need of air, or perhaps only for something to do, he fumbled with the latch of the shutters and thrust them halfway open, flooding the room with the sound of rushing water and the cold, fresh smell of rain. "Are you trying to tell me you don't want me to stay?" I said finally. "Because if so, I mean, I know you'll have a life now. Maybe you have
other ties. With unnaturally acute senses, I could hear the small sounds of activity throughout the house below, even above the rush of the storm and the pounding of my own heart. My palms were damp, and I wiped them surreptitiously against my skirt. He turned from the window to stare at me.
"Christ," he said, "not want you."
His face was pale now and his eyes unnaturally bright.
"I have burned for you for 20 years, Sassenach," he said softly. "Do you not know that? Jesus!"
The breeze stirred the loose wisps of hair around his face and he brushed them back impatiently.
"But I'm no the man ye knew 20 years past, am I?"
He turned away with a gesture of frustration.
"We know each other now less than we did when we wed."
"Do you want me to go?" The blood was pounding thickly in my ears.
"No!"
He swung quickly toward me and gripped my shoulder tightly, making me pull back involuntarily.
"No," he said, more quietly. "I dinna want you to go. I told you so and I meant it. But I must know."
He bent his head toward me, his face alive with troubled question.
"Do you want me?" he whispered. "Sassenach, will you take me and risk the man that I am for the sake of the man you knew?"
I felt a great wave of relief mingled with fear. It ran from his hand on my shoulder to the tips of my toes, weakening my joints. "It's a lot too late to ask that," I said, and reached to touch his cheek, where the rough beard was starting to show. It was soft under my fingers, like stiff plush. "Because I've already risked everything I had. But whoever you are now, Jamie Fraser, yes, yes, I do want you." The light of the candle flame glowed blue in his eyes as he held out his hands to me, and I stepped wordless into his embrace. I rested my face against his chest, marvelling at the feel of him in my arms, so big, so solid and warm, real, after the years of longing for a ghost I couldn't touch. Disentangling himself after a moment, he looked down at me and touched my cheek very gently. He smiled slightly.
"You've the devil's own courage, aye. But then, you always did."
I tried to smile at him, but my lips trembled. "How about you? How do you know what I'm like?
You don't know what I've been doing for the last 20 years either. I might be a horrible person, for all you know."
The smile on his lips moved into his eyes, lighting them with humour.
"I suppose you might at that. But you know, Sassenach, I dinna think I care."
I stood looking at him for another minute, then heaved a deep sigh that popped a few more stitches in my gown.
"Neither do I."
It seemed absurd to be shy with him, but shy I was. The adventures of the evening and his words to me had opened up the chasm of reality, those 20 unshared years that gaped between us, and the unknown future that lay beyond. Now we had come to the place where we would begin to know each other again, and discover whether we were, in fact, the same two who had once existed as one flesh, and whether we might be one again. A knock at the door broke the tension. It was a small serving maid with a tray of supper. She bobbed shyly to me, smiled at Jamie, and laid both supper, cold meat, hot broth, and warm oat bread with butter, and the fire, with a quick and practised hand, then left us with a murmured, "Good e'en to ye." We ate slowly, talking carefully only of neutral things. I told him how I had made my way from Craigner Dun to Inverness, and made him laugh with stories of Mr. Graham and Master Georgie. He in turn told me about Mr. Willoughby, how he had found the little Chinese, half-starved and dead-drunk, lying behind a row of casks on the docks at Burnt Island, one of the shipping ports near Edinburgh. We said nothing much of ourselves, but as we ate,
I became increasingly conscious of his body, watching his fine, long hands as he poured wine and cut meat, seeing the twist of his powerful torso under his shirt, and the graceful line of neck and shoulder as he stooped to retrieve a fallen napkin. Once or twice, I thought I saw his gaze linger on me in the same way, a sort of hesitant avidity. But he quickly glanced away each time, hooding his eyes so that I couldn't tell what he saw or felt. As the supper concluded, the same thought was uppermost in both our minds. It could scarcely be otherwise, considering the place in which we found ourselves. A tremor of mingled fear and anticipation shot through me. At last, he drained his wine glass, set it down, and met my eyes directly.
"Will you?"
He stopped, the flush deepening on his features, but met my eyes, swallowed once, and went on.
"Will you come to bed, Weimer, then? I mean," he hurried on, "it's cold and we're both damp and..."
"And there aren't any chairs," I finished for him. "All right." I pulled my hand loose from his and turned toward the bed, feeling a queer mix of excitement and hesitance that made my breath come short. He pulled off his breeches and stockings quickly, then glanced at me.
"I'm sorry, Sassenach. I should have thought you'd need help with your laces."
So he didn't undress women often, I thought, before I could stop myself. And my lips curved in a smile at the thought.
"Well, it's not laces," I murmured, "but if you'd give a hand in the back there..."
I laid aside my cloak and turned my back to him, lifting my hair to expose the back of the dress. There was a puzzled silence. Then I felt a finger sliding slowly down the groove of my backbone.
"What's that?" he said,
sounding startled.
"It's called a zipper," I said,
smiling, though he couldn't see me.
"See the little tab at the top? Just take hold of that and pull it straight down."
The zipper teeth parted with a muted ripping noise, and the remnants of Jessica Gutenberg sagged free. I pulled my arms out of the sleeves and let the dress drop heavily around my feet, turning to face Jamie before I lost my nerve. He jerked back, startled by this sudden chrysalis shedding. Then he blinked and stared at me. I stood in front of him in nothing but my shoes and gartered rose silk stockings. I had an overwhelming urge to snatch the dress back up, but I resisted it. I stiffened my spine, raised my chin, and waited. He didn't say a word. His eyes gleamed in the candlelight as he moved his head slightly, but he still had that trick of hiding all his thoughts behind an inscrutable mask. "Will you bloody say something?" I demanded at last, in a voice that shook only a little. His mouth opened, but no words came out. He shook his head slowly from side to side.
"Jesus," he whispered at last. "Claire, you are the most beautiful woman I have ever seen."
"You," I said with conviction, "are losing your eyesight. It's probably glaucoma. You're too young for cataracts."
He laughed at that, a little unsteadily. And then I saw that he was, in fact, blinded. His eyes shone with moisture even as he smiled. He blinked hard and held out his hand.
"I," he said with equal conviction, "have got eyes like a hawk, and always did. Come here to me."
A little reluctantly, I took his hand and stepped out of the inadequate shelter of the remains of my dress. He drew me gently in to stand between his knees as he sat on the bed. Then he kissed me softly, once on each breast, and laid his head between them, his breath coming warm on my bare skin.
"Your breast is like ivory," he said softly,
the word almost priest in the Highland Scots that always grew broad when he was truly moved. His hand rose to cut one breast, his fingers tanned into darkness against my own pale glow.
"Only to see them,
sae full and sae round. Christ, I could lay my head here forever. But to touch him, Assassinach, you, your skin like white velvet and the sweet long lines of your body.
He paused, and I could feel the working of his throat muscles as he swallowed, his hand moving slowly down the curving slope of waist and hip, the swell and taper of buttock and thigh.
"Dear God," he said, still softly. "I couldna look at ye, Assassinach, and keep my hands from you, nor have ye near me and not want ye."
He lifted his head then and planted a kiss over my heart, then let his hand float down the gentle curve of my belly, lightly tracing the small marks left there by Brianna's birth.
"You really don't mind?"
I said hesitantly, brushing my own fingers over my stomach. He smiled up at me with something half rueful in his expression. He hesitated for a moment, then drew up the hem of his shirt.
"Do you?" he asked.
The scar ran from mid-thigh nearly to his groin, an 8-inch length of twisted whitish tissue. I couldn't repress a gasp at its appearance, and dropped to my knees beside him. I laid my cheek on his thigh, holding tight to his leg, as though I would keep him now, as I hadn't been able to keep him then. I could feel the slow, deep pulse of the blood through his femoral artery under my fingers, a bare inch away from the ugly gully of that twisting scar.
"That doesn't affright you, nor sicken you, Assassinach?"
he asked, laying a hand on my hair. I lifted my head and stared up at him.
"Of course not."
"Aye, well."
He reached to touch my stomach, his eyes holding mine.
"And if ye bear the scars of your own battle, Assassinach," he said softly, "that dinna trouble me either."
He lifted me to the bed beside him then and leaned to kiss me. I kicked off my shoes and curled my legs up, feeling the warmth of him through his shirt. My hands found the button at the throat, fumbling to open it.
"I want to see you."
"Well, it's no much to see, Assassinach,"
he said with an uncertain laugh.
"But whatever it is, it's yours, if you want it."
He pulled the shirt over his head and tossed it on the floor, then leaned back on the palms of his hands, displaying his body. I didn't know quite what I'd been expecting. In fact, the sight of his naked body took my breath away. He was still tall, of course, and beautifully made, the long bones of his body sleek with muscle, elegant with strength. He glowed in the candlelight, as though the light came from within him. He had changed, of course, but the change was subtle, as though he had been put into an oven and baked to a hard finish. He looked as though both muscle and skin had drawn in just a bit, grown closer to the bone, so he was more tightly knit. He had never seemed gawky, but the last hint of boyish looseness had vanished. His skin had darkened slightly, to a pale gold, burned to bronze on face and throat, paling down the length of his body to a pure white, tinged with blue veins in the hollow of his thighs. His pubic hair stood out in a ferocious auburn bush, and it was quite obvious that he hadn't been lying. He did want me, and very badly. My eyes met his, and his mouth quirked suddenly.
"I did see once I would be honest with you, Assassinach."
I laughed, feeling tears sting my eyes at the same time, a rush of confused emotions surging up in me.
So did I.
I reached toward him, hesitant, and he took my hand. The strength and warmth of it was startling, and I jerked slightly. Then I tightened my grasp, and he rose to his feet, facing me. We stood still then, awkwardly hesitating. We were intensely aware of each other. How could we not be? It was quite a small room, and the available atmosphere was completely filled with a charge like static electricity, almost strong enough to be visible. I had a feeling of empty-bellied terror, like the sort you get at the top of a roller coaster.
Are you as scared as I am? I finally said, sounding hoarse to my own ears. He looked me over carefully and raised one eyebrow.
I don't think I can be, he said. You're covered with goose flesh.
Are you scared, Sassenach,
or only cold?
Both, I said, and he laughed.
Get in, then, he said.
He released my hand and bent to turn back the quilt. I didn't stop shaking when he slid under the quilt beside me, though the heat of his body was a physical shock. God, you're not cold, I blurted. I turned toward him and the warmth of him shimmered against my skin from head to toes. Instinctively drawn, I pressed close against him, shivering. I could feel my nipples tight and hard against his chest and the sudden shock of his naked skin against my own. He laughed, a little uncertainly.
No, I'm not. I suppose I must be afraid, eh?
His arms came around me gently, and I touched his chest, feeling hundreds of tiny goosebumps spring up under my fingertips among the ruddy curling hairs.
When we were afraid of each other before, I whispered, on our wedding night, you held my hands. You said it would be easier if we touched.
He made a small sound as my fingertip found his nipple.
I did, he said, sounding breathless. Lord, touch me like that again.
His hands tightened suddenly, holding me against him.
Touch me, he said again softly, and let me touch you, my Sassenach.
His hand cupped me, stroking, touching, and my breast lay taut and heavy in his palm. I went on trembling, but now he was doing it too.
When we wed, he whispered,
his breath warm against my cheek.
And I saw you there, so bonny in your white dress. I couldn't think of anything but when we'd be alone, and I could undo your laces and have you naked next to me in the bed.
Do you want me now? I whispered, and kissed the sunburned flesh in the hollow above his collarbone. His skin was faintly salty to the taste, and his hair smelled of wood smoke and pungent maleness. He didn't answer, but moved abruptly, so I felt the hardness of him stiff against my belly. It was terror as much as desire that pressed me close against him. I wanted him, all right. My breasts ached and my belly was tight with it, the unaccustomed rush of arousal slippery between my legs opening me for him. But as strong as lust was the desire simply to be taken, to have him master me, quell my doubts in a moment of rough usage, take me hard and swiftly enough to make me forget myself. I could feel the urge to do it tremble in the hands that cupped my buttocks, in the involuntary jerk of his hips, brought up short as he stopped himself. Do it, I thought, in an agony of apprehension. For God's sake, do it now, and don't be gentle. I couldn't say it. I saw the need of it on his face, but he couldn't say it either. It was both too soon and too late for such words between us. But we had shared another language, and my body still recalled it. I pressed my hips against him sharply, grasping his, the curves of his buttocks clenched hard under my hands. I turned my face upward, urgent to be kissed, at the same moment that he bent abruptly to kiss me. My nose hit his forehead with a sickening crunch. My eyes watered profusely as I rolled away from him, clutching my face. Ow! Christ, have I hurt you, Claire? Blinking away the tears, I could see his face hovering anxiously over me.
No, I said stupidly. My nose is broken, though, I think.
No, it isn't, he said, gently feeling the bridge of my nose. When you break your nose, it makes a nasty crunching sound and you bleed like a pig.
It's all right.
I felt gingerly beneath my nostrils, but he was right. I wasn't bleeding. The pain had receded quickly, too. As I realized that,
I also realized that he was lying on me, my legs sprawled wide beneath him, his cock just touching me, no more than a hair's breadth from the moment of decision. I saw the realization.